My name is Sarah Kim, and I'm from Austin, Texas. I'm a Cheeselandian because while life is great, cheese makes it better. Go to Cheeselandia.com to learn more, and if it's for you, sign up.
This week on Meatin' 3, we head into the second part of our mini-series on global trade, where we talk about all things sweet, from chocolate and sugarcane to the cultural festival that accompanied the growth of the date industry in the U.S.
They're using this romance and fantasy to say, dates are exotic and you should consume them.
I'd like to think of the food that we eat as archaeological artifacts, in part because the history of humanity is in the stands in your produce market.
It's not like other foods. We have very personal feelings about chocolate.
Tune in to Meatin' 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection of food and grief, with your hosts, me, Zara Tangora, and my adorable, wonderful, lovely mother, Bobby Conforto, who is not with us for the intro, but as always, with us in spirit. Today, we are welcoming Monica O'Connell, an amazing guest. We had such a beautiful talk with Monica. As with all of our guests, I feel like I always say this, and it's true, and it was definitely true with Monica. I feel like we could have talked to her for hours and hours. Monica is a cake designer, baker, writer, and a former French horn player, and she also holds a PhD in ethnomusicology. We just had an incredible conversation about a variety of, you know, different really intense loss experiences and grief experiences that Monica has had over the past year. She had a way of putting things that was so touching and so beautiful. It definitely brought us to tears at a few points during the episode. We're so excited about this talk, and Monica's cakes are gorgeous. Her business is called Curtis and Cake, and please check it out. We're going to put a link to it in our Instagram. She's an incredible human, dynamic and lovely and wise. And the talk was just so great. Can't wait for you guys to listen to it. And just hoping that everyone's okay out there in the kind of thick of winter. Obviously, there's so much happening in this country and world, and it's a tough time. And, you know, there are little kind of nuggets of joy out there. And, you know, for Bobby and I know doing this show is definitely one of them. And hopefully hearing these stories and getting to connect with people, knowing that, you know, people are dealing with a lot and going through a lot, you're not alone. And also finding ways to be in their grief, to come out of their grief, to, you know, manage their grief. I hope that these episodes are helping you guys. They're definitely helping me. I can say that for sure. So sending a lot of love to all of you listeners, and thank you so much for your continued support of the show. It's really wonderful to be able to do this. So please enjoy Monica O'Connell. We really did. And yeah, be good to yourselves and each other. And we will see you next week. Bye. So, welcome to Processing. We're here today with Monica O'Connell. Monica, hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Hello.
Afternoon.
Good morning. Hello. And you are joining us from Georgia.
From Conyers, Georgia. So I'm in the deep wooded suburbs of Atlanta.
Wow. Mm. Amazing. And you recently moved there from Wisconsin, right?
Yes. It was a whole thing to survive, but yeah, we made it. So we closed November 9th.
Wow, amazing.
It's a homecoming.
Good luck in your new home.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So what's that been like? What's the kind of transition? Because, you know, Bobby and I are Long Islanders. We're very much like East Coasters. I've lived in the city for a long time in Brooklyn and in Manhattan. And I don't have a ton of experience with either the Midwest or the South. So could you just tell us a little bit about, like, I guess, what is it like having transitioned from Wisconsin to Georgia?
Well, it's been kind of like an exhale, to be honest. there was so much that I loved and appreciated about being in or being close to Madison. We lived in a small town called Fort Atkinson that was about 45 minutes south of Madison in Wisconsin. And a lot of that was food culture, and the fact that you have four proper seasons, and all of the really rich relationships with farmers and all the potential that that entails was coming alive in my life there. But the, you know, the facts are the demographics are just really harsh for people of color. And coming home, coming to Atlanta and seeing every day my entire diaspora represented is, you know, it's pretty beautiful. I feel at home.
That's great. That's yeah. great. That feeling of being at home is really priceless, isn't it? Like when you just feel like you belong and you're like the sense of relief when you set aside relief, it really, that's a great visual to put to that.
It is. And I'm relieved that that's what I'm experiencing because yeah. I was nervous about coming back and, you know, you make all these stories about what that means, but.
Sure. Yeah, I know. Good. Right. Like when those stories that we tell ourselves about what could happen and the potential, like, for, you know, disaster or bad things or good things, whatever the assumption is always, it's like almost never like that in any, right. I don't know any time in my life or what I've assumed will happen ever actually really happens. But
And yeah. yet we have to keep learning that lesson.
Mm-hmm. I know it is one lesson that never fully gets learned. It's very funny. So what have you been cooking? What have you, you're a baker and you have a cake business and, but what have you been kind of making in your personal life? I mean, since you've moved, what are the kind of things you've got going on?
I won't say that I don't have the baking business anymore. I'll say it's in deep transition. Mm. And what I've been baking and making, you know, around the holidays, of course, I was just going into complete insane overdrive. with the cookies and the rum cake and all other kinds of things. But I guess what's been really nice about this moment is that I don't have that public facing thing of having the business. So I am able to just read cookbooks for pleasure again and really follow other people's recipes and just kind of enjoy that. And I had forgotten, I don't know, just how enjoyable that is and how fun that is. And, you know, it kind of lights me up. So just been trying different things. My project this weekend is fried chicken.
Yum.
Yeah. I've made it. Maybe I can count on one hand how many times I've made that. And that's a whole thing. So
yeah. Do you do a buttermilk brine?
I'm going to do the buttermilk brine. I'm going to get on that today. And, yeah, hopefully not burn the house down tomorrow.
Yeah. I made fried chicken this weekend, and I also haven't made it that many times. And I had, like, some dehydrated sour cream that I had made during quarantine when I was trying to, like, really homestead, like, hardcore. And I was like, I'll make my own sour cream powder. And so I was like, what is this shit in the back of my cabinet? And I grabbed it down, and it was powdered sour cream. And I put it in the flour batter, and then I also sprinkled it on top. It was quite good. I gotta say,
yummy.
Yeah, but I also
that
like
sounds
had
amazing.
It was delicious. It was really, really good. It was really good. Yeah, you know, I understand when you were just talking about kind of being able to cook for pleasure again and like kind of unwinding. I had a restaurant for like 7 years, and I decided to close it for a variety of reasons, but mainly because it felt like really oppressive to my personhood, you know what I mean? I was just like suffocating with the amount of stress and pressure. And I had such a similar feeling when I closed. I was so sad to have lost the business, but like the relief, the kind of sigh of relief to get to do normal things, like read, like when you're saying reading a cookbook and like enjoying cooking for myself and stuff, like that really resonates a lot with me. And also Bobby, you too. I mean, Bobby had a food business and closed it. How did you have that feeling, Mom, when you closed either of your businesses?
Yeah, it's, you know, as a baker or a chef, you know, when you cook for yourself, it's just a different approach. It's, you know, I think when I first started cooking for myself again, I wanted to cook for 200 people instead of two, you know, because I'm used to quantity. I still have a problem with that. I still make big quantities rather than quantities for two.
Totally. You know, I think what I'm kind of struck by is just the, like, it's an interesting thing when you get to be in a profession where you actually do what you love. You know, I think that, like, that's such a kind of common trope that we hear, like, oh, do what you love. And, like, a lot of people don't do what they love, right? Like, that's just work. That's kind of how work works for most of us. And then when you do something you love, it's very interesting because mixing your, you know, passion and work, because work is often grueling, it's an interesting kind of crossroads. Did you feel that in your business with cakes, that you, did you feel any of that kind of pressure mingling with your passion? Like, how did you handle that? Yeah.
So much. I mean, yeah, I always say, like, I loved having this business, except for the business part.
Totally.
And it's, you know, it's hard because it's such a private challenge. You can't, you know, people are always saying that to you. God, it must be so nice to sort of sit around and decorate cakes all day. Or it must be so nice, you know, like, what do you think I do? But you can't, you know, can't get into that whole sort of deep bitch session that you maybe want to get into. But yeah, I definitely felt that. And it's kind of a relief to be moving into what I think is going to be a period where I can more focus on the parts that I really love so deeply and not be worried about, I don't know, what a terrible capitalist I am.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, it's interesting in our capitalist society, you know, we don't talk about we're taught, you know, pull yourselves up by your bootstraps and get to work and start your own business. And we don't really, it's not really represented how painful it is actually to be a small business owner in such an incredibly capitalist, ruthlessly capitalist society. And, like, you know, when you don't see it, it's very difficult to understand that, like, going into it, that that's how it can feel, and how, I don't know, how doing something you love can actually be incredibly painful. We don't ever really talk about that as a society.
Yeah.
And it's tough, yeah, because it can, like, it can really ruin for me, I'll speak for myself. It can really, like, I don't want to say ruin, but it can really complicate your relationship with your passion, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Bobby, you do what you love. How do you feel?
To tell you the truth, what I'm thinking about is artists. You know, anybody that's an artist, when you start to try to sell your art, they don't cohabitate well. It kind of takes something away from your the meaning behind what you're doing. And I noticed, Monica, in some of the reading that I read about you, some of the articles, that you've always considered your work meaningful and filled with love. Is that how you like to say it?
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really so important to me.
Yeah. So what happens when all of a sudden we have, you know, have to worry about paying bills, and we have to worry about, you know, how to make enough profit, you know, and then all of a sudden, what's the meaning shifts? So.
Right.
So tell us more. Your business was in Wisconsin, and it mm-hmm. was and tell us the name.
The name of the business was and still is Curtis and Cake. There's a whole story behind that name, and this kind of gets to what you were just saying about, you know, my need to just kind of build that meaning in every way. So it's always about this kind of deep textured description for me. And I don't know, that bumps up against that capitalist urge too, right? Because we don't have time. Like, just please sell me the cake and let's move on.
Yes. Yeah.
yeah. But yeah. I don't know. I think the storytelling is just such an important part of it for me anyway. So yeah, the cake part, I guess, is pretty obvious, but the Curtis came from, it came from, let me just go back for a minute. My mom was an extraordinary hostess, and she used to throw really these great house parties. And so I do have this really lovely memory of sitting on the steps as a kid in our house during one of these parties and just munching on this slice of a really hunk, because the cake was so saturated with rum that it wouldn't really make a clean slice. But just eating this rum cake, sitting on the stairs and watching the grown folks dance to Curtis Mayfield. So, that's where the Curtis comes from.
Ah.
And it's just this kind of nice reminder of that memory for me, and just of that idea that the cake is never just the cake. It's, it's the music, it's the people, it's the relationships. So,
yeah. Yeah. It is such a rich thing. And it's interesting when you're talking about just like knowing how much meaning your own work has to you, and then trying to like convey it in a way where there's that like appropriate amount of time between, you know what I mean? Like, especially with food, being able to tell people like, hey, this is my inspiration, this is what it's about. When you said, hey, I just want the cake, as the customer. But like, you don't want to just give them cake. So it's like finding the like line between being able to be your authentic self and how do you like allow people to really see that, and how much does it matter that they see that? Some people will see it more than others. It's like such an interesting kind of balance of that. So how did you get into making cakes? How did that journey begin for you?
First, I just have to say, already I think you're really such a lovely interviewer and conversationalist.
Thank you.
I want to respond to, I think what you were saying, the comments, I thought that was just such an interesting part of having, especially a food business, especially one where I'm investing so much power. It's a tension, but it's also this kind of dance to find that balance, right? Yeah. How much of the story do you tell? And learning to be sensitive to other people's needs, because really sometimes they really just need the cake.
Yes.
But also, listening to your own needs and your own, what the things that are lighting you up. And for me, I always wanted to focus more on the story part.
Totally.
And so the dance kind of started twirling in that direction. But I started making them because I was at a super stressful job in Chicago. I went to grad school. I was a very sort of dutiful, good student, Virgo person for a really long time.
Yeah.
And I got that PhD, and I probably was among the last cohort of graduate students who really felt that they were promised like a certain thing, tenure, and there were just certain assurances. Of course that all started blowing up in real time. I did land this big job, directing the Center for Black Music Research, which was, still is an extraordinary collection, but was this really unique confluence of scholars and archival resources and all this stuff. And I just went there believing that I was going to really actively help change the world from my little corner of Chicago. But institutional politics got in the way and I got stressed out. So started baking. Like so many people do, just to kind of manage the stress. And I just fell in love first with just the immediacy. It's just such a joyful thing. And you can just connect with people and you make them happy right away, as opposed to like, writing an article that some people will read a year later. And
That's very interesting. That point is very interesting about like your previous kind of career path. And then that's a long game. That's such a long game. And also so frustrating, because sometimes you never get a chance to see the ways in which you are able to impact someone. And so with like something like baking, that kind of gratification. I can relate to that so much in terms of my own cooking and my own love of professional cooking, is like that thing when you see somebody be like, oh my God, it's so soul satisfying in a way that almost nothing else is, right? But I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to hear more about how you got to cakes. So you were doing it as a way to kind of de-stress from your past profession and your career trajectory, and then how did it turn from a passion into a job?
I still don't know. It just kind of evolved. I was baking more and more to the point that I think it was starting to get on my colleagues' nerves. bringing a cake in or two every week. I don't know. We needed sugar.
Totally. I hear that.
And a dear friend and colleague of mine asked me to make a special birthday cake for her son. And I got overly ambitious, as I am wont to do. And I tried to make this sort of two-tier fondant covered sort of character cake for this kid. And I could tell you all the many, many ways that I really messed that cake up. I'll spare the details, but you know that that scene in Close Encounters where Richard Dreyfuss is sitting at the table with the mashed potatoes and like trying to make the
mountain thing?
Yeah. Ended up looking like this sort of chocolate mountain of, I don't know, mashed potato mush. It was, oh my gosh. Guess what? God. Kids loved it. They didn't care.
I bet. That's hilarious. Is that feeling when you start? I had the same thing happen the other day with a cake, actually, and it turned out fine, but I was making like an olive oil cake for a photo shoot. And it was supposed to be like this Aperol spritz cake. And my friend has this saying that really stuck with me. At first I found it to be incredibly annoying, but it really stays with me. He says, the hurrier I go, the behinder I get. And so that is what happened to me the other day. And I was doing the same. I took the cake out of the pan too early. So part of it stuck. Then I'm like mushing it together. I'm like pouring syrup on top. Then I'm like jamming like some kind of like weird decorations into it. In the end, it turned out fine. But I so relate to that feeling of being like, get back in here.
Because baking is a process.
It is.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful thing, right? Yeah. Once you finally sort of catch on.
Yeah.
It's not about perfection. It's all about the process of making it and everything that it gives to you and what you imbue into it. What I heard you say before is that people may not know what we put into what we make, but we know.
Yeah.
And I think that's what really matters.
Very beautiful, Bobby. It's true. And that makes it hard, though, too. That makes it hard. And especially as a business owner, I think, going back to that point, that's what makes it hard. And I think that's, for me at least, where the switch was in my head with, like, doing what you love, is that you do know what goes into it. You know, like, the pain that went into it, why you might have begun this business or begun doing this for people. You know, like, you know, the daily struggles that you might have that you're pouring into it, or like the rent that maybe like can't be paid, or the person that quit and yelled at you or whatever, you know, and all the stuff. And then you deliver them the food or the cake and they're like either excited or whatever. They're like kind of just like, you know, not too excited, or they don't like it or they love it. And like that feeling of like, you'll never know what I put into this so you could enjoy it. And it's interesting. I think we have to, one thing that I've kind of learned, and I'm still not great at it, but is trying to like compartmentalize that. The reaction doesn't have to define the process for us. You know what I mean? In a lot of things, not just in professional cooking, but in like life, like the, like people's reaction to what we put out doesn't define like our intention, you know?
Right.
That's another lifelong lesson. And
this is the thing. This is the beautiful thing about cake, right? I mean, all the life lessons are there.
Totally.
I really think it's true.
Absolutely. So you were mentioning that your mom threw amazing house parties. And was your mom also a cook? Like, did she like to bake cake? Where did this, you know, and what was it like growing up? I know that you mentioned your pre-interview that you guys were so close and she was your person. And I'm just curious to know like the food relationship there and if she helped guide you in this way.
Yeah, she definitely did. She was really the sort of the motivation, the inspiration behind kind of more formally starting the business. And there was a lot about our shared relationship around food that I wanted to communicate through Curtis and Cake. So a lot of what I understood as the specialness of what I was doing, I mean, not like what I was doing, but the specialness of those kinds of building those kinds of relationships through the medium of cake came from things that I did with my mom early on. And we all were always up to some kind of project. So it's hard to say, like, yes, we were bakers, or I learned how to make X, Y, and Z at her side. It was a little more sort of scattered and, I don't know, sometimes frantic than that. We're always trying something new. And sometimes it was more like, well, let's make wreaths this year, you know, for the neighbors instead of cookies. But it was always some sort of hospitality oriented project. You know, let's learn how to make jelly this year. Let's, you know, let's make chocolate candy. So it was always something different, but it was fun. It was quality time with her. And the thing I learned from it was not so much how to like make the perfect, you know, whatever, but more just, here's just this really lovely, fun way to, I don't know, show people you love them, or to, you know, to care for folks.
Yeah. Well, hospitality, as you mentioned.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That's an incredible thing to absorb. And so your mother unfortunately passed away this past year. And I'm so sorry to hear that. It's such a devastating loss. And
thank you.
Can you just tell us a little bit about kind of how that experience was for you in terms of what a hectic time? Obviously, that loss is so profound, and you had mentioned that you were going through so many other transitions personally and also on, you know, a national level, with like so much grief happening over the summer with, you know, violence and murder of Black people in this country by the police. And it was such a intense time for you. Can you just talk a little bit about what this past year has been like in regards to some of that stuff, but also her passing?
Sure. It was just a lot. It was just too much. Yeah, I mean, I still don't feel like I know how to articulate that period. How it happened. I don't know how to talk about it well. But I can say that it just was. It was just like such a. It was just heartbreaking, and made so much more so because of everything that was going on around me at the time. It would have been enough just to deal with my mom's passing. That would have been enough. But I think there was just this way that, you know, for better and worse, this thing that kind of made it much, much more difficult, but ultimately better for me, in a weird way, was that there was no closing off. You know, the wound was just like sort of made to stay fresh, because there was so much to grieve this past spring, on so many levels. So for me, just personally and as an individual, and normally that's just such a private, it's just such an individual private thing, you know, the way you grieve for your person. but it always had this collective element, because of everything that was happening with COVID, and because of everything that was happening with Ahmaud Arbery, with Breonna Taylor, with George Floyd, with, you know, the names just kept coming. It just kept happening. So there kind of wasn't this healing, and I was sort of forced. Now I could say gifted, but then it did not feel that way. To kind of just sit with this sort of open, gaping wound, and just kind of be with it.
Yeah, that is one of the things about grief that they don't tell you, and especially mounting grief. And it's so awful that it so often happens that things collide in this way where, it, you know, you have a loss and then you have another loss and then you have things that are happening outside of your control in your personal life that are horrible and difficult and painful and mind-bending in their injustice. And, you know, I can just speak from the times that I've had that have felt similarly, that you sit and you almost freeze and you're like, I don't understand how life works like this, because nobody ever really tells you that life works like this. We know people die. We know that horrible things happen in the world, but sometimes like it's enough to like numb you and drop your jaw to the ground. And I think it really is, right. You know, it's a cliche, but it really is only in hindsight that you're able to take a look and be like, wow, when that wound was open, when I was at the bottom, I actually mentioned to our mutual friend, Lisa Cole Broland, in an interview once that she was asking, you know, kind of a similar question. What did you learn from your lowest time? And I was like, you know, in hindsight, I learned there's something about being down there at the very bottom that you never wish to go there. And while you're there, you're never like, oh, I think I'd like to stay longer here. But like,
and you don't think you can survive it either when you're in it.
Right. But in retrospect, man, what an interesting underworld there is there to like poke around at. Then when you think back at it, you're like, oh, it's like almost being at the bottom of the deep sea. And you're like, oh, look, there was those weird neon glowing fish. And I don't know if anyone else has ever seen those, but I have. And, you know, I have in my memory that bizarre things exist I thought I could never see or my mind couldn't wrap itself around. And when you come back up, I don't know, it's a tool. And it's not a tool you'd ask for, but I think it still is. Personally, I think it still is a tool. Do you feel that way at all?
It is. It's essential, right? I love the way you put that. It does feel... And I know we're not the only ones that have made that sort of comparison with the sea or the ocean or, you know, with grief, because it is, you're kind of going down to this place and you feel like you have had all the air knocked out of you and you feel like you can't breathe, you know, like you said, Bobby, like you don't think you're going to survive it, but yet like with each minute you're like, but I am somehow still here. I don't understand how. I don't know how I can even, like, how do I exist without this person? Like, how can I be here still? But you are. And yeah, I guess if you can have a kind of curiosity, I don't even want to say bravery, but just some kind of curiosity about what's down there, what those creatures are doing and what they look like.
That's what faith is. You know, faith is being able to be in that moment of the darkest time and have what you call curiosity for the next breath and the next moment and the next moment. And that's how we get through. But what you said about how do I ever learn to live with this? I think that we live with grief our whole life and we don't have to figure it out all at once. And it's continually evolving, you know, the understanding of what we miss in our life and what we long for in our life and what we lost in our life, but we still have, you know, we begin to find it again in a new way.
Right. You know? Yeah. That's so important. It is always changing, isn't it?
Yes, it really is. So it sounds like you had a convergence of many things happening at the same time.
Yes. All the rugs are pulled.
Yes. Yeah.
Wild. It's wild how it happens like that. And not to mention that, you know, during COVID and a time when, I know Bobby specifically wanted to talk to you about some points about this, but when like the little thing that we have, most of us, some of us, to hold on to are the rituals surrounding loss and death, right? Like
totally.
Being with people and you know, funerals of whatever kind that is, or wakes or shivas or whatever way, you know, your family, your culture celebrates is important. It's like the little win, you know, and that is taken away from folks during this kind of time. It's brutal. It's like, that's unfair.
Monica, you wrote such a beautiful piece in Unpeeled. And may I read it to our readers, to our listeners?
Oh,
it's
sure.
So beautiful. You said, my mom died in April, just a few months ago, just as everything seemed to be going wrong. And to have that happen in the midst of this pandemic, where certain modes of sharing grieving aren't even available, has been really difficult. one of the rites of Black hospitality is the Black repast. There is just a way that family and friends remember people together through the visitation and the service, and it is totally interwoven with food. And I didn't get that food. I didn't get that fried chicken and my mom's coconut cake and the mac and cheese. And it's always something I'm thinking about, how important the food is. Food runs through all of it. With the Black repast, there's going to be pound cake. There's going to be sweet potato pie, and there's going to be potato salad. That consistency, that continuity is powerful. And again, I think about the cakes at these times. I'm just always thinking of that. It seems strange at a time that in the days following my mom's death, I just wanted to work on a cake design. So hers was my first grief cake, actually. And I just used all sorts of kitchen things that made me feel connected to her. And I just was trying to make a tribute, a poem for her, out of this cake. It had wild rice on it and black birch, sumac seeds, and other things that would make some kind of statement about how beautiful she was.
You're going to make me cry. We're all crying.
We are. Oh my gosh. Monica, that was so beautifully said.
It was. Bobby and I also cried this morning when we were talking, when Bobby read that over the phone to me this morning when I was actually decorating a cake, oddly enough. But
yeah,
I mean, just in terms of the like traditions surrounding like grief, you know, that you had in your family and like what not being able to do that. I mean, I'd love if you could talk about that a bit, but also I add on to that, like, what did you do instead? Were you able to do something else that was, I don't know.
It, Bobby, thank you for reading that, reminding me. it felt like some like Job level stuff, man, for a minute there. Totally. You really kind of, you know, start to wonder like, okay, I'm good. I've got some lesson material to work with. I don't need anymore. I missed that. And my family certainly has its version of, of all of those rituals, the funeral, the repast. And so I missed seeing my family, my extended family, and sort of being able to celebrate my mom in that way. My mom, to say she deserved that is, you know, such a sad understatement. She minimally deserved the people that were important to her coming together and celebrating her in a kind of, communion in a shared space. And what we had instead was a Facebook Live, which is just insulting. I'm already so ambivalent about that platform. Totally. And it just, it was just so dreadfully insufficient. But the other thing about the repast, and people much smarter than me have written about it, but that's how the specific gets connected to the collective. That's how you kind of tap in. Those rituals are the ways that you get connected to your elders, to a lineage. That's the way you ground. And I had to find other ways to do that. I had to find other ways to ground myself. And I think that's where the miracle part of that spring came in. And that's where that gift of just the quiet of social distancing and the quarantining, and kind of everyone, you know, being required to slow down. That was such a gift for me because I was able to take, I just took these walks. I just took walks. and because I was, there was nowhere to be, and I was at sort of the bottom of that sea anyway, so I was not
making any effort or striving in any way to be anywhere else. And I was just, I was just able to be on such intimate terms with the, with spring happening and just seeing it happen like day to day, and being a, feeling like I was a part of that and feeling right-sized in that cycle was just such a, it was just such a profound miracle. It was really like, I'm not overstating it. It was the way to get through.
Fertility.
Spring, yeah. Spring is an interesting time because I think that like people think of it because of the colors and because of the flowers and because of the baby animals and the coming back from the winter. It is a beautiful time in a way, but it's also a very intense time. What?
Not in Wisconsin.
Oh, true. Not in New York either. But it's also like, I've always found spring to be a very intense time. Like the breaking out of like the winter, while it's like great, but there's, for me at least, I've always felt the energy in spring, and not intense negatively, just intense. Like it, just something about spring. It's like, you know, to use the metaphor or the imagery of like a chick breaking out of its shell, like that's cute, but it's also hard. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like sweaty work.
It's sweaty work. It's hard. It's like sharp edges. You know, you're like in this shell, and then all of a sudden you're in the world again, and it's kind
And then, like, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, but, no, please.
You know, one of the great things Wisconsin gave to me was the state fair, the county fair, which I had never experienced before. So I have seen these chicks now. The city girl has seen the chicks. And I love how they, like, they do all of that work. And you're right, it's so much work, and there are all these sharp edges. But they make it out, and they immediately have to take a nap.
Yeah, totally.
Immediately.
Exactly.
They just fall asleep.
That's what spring feels like for me.
Well, Elizabeth Lesser said it very well in her book, Broken Open, one of my favorite books. And it's just that breaking open. And that's what I imagine when you say that, Sarah. What spring is about, breaking open. And it's painful. And it's hard. And it's, you release a lot to make room for new.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, go ahead, Bobby.
No, I was just, I was so interested in something, just to shift a little bit gears. When you talk about Black hospitality, I was just so interested. And I want to hear more about that. And I understand that it's something you're going to be writing about.
I am. I did start writing in earnest and start really thinking about that because I missed certain manifestations of it, you know, after my mom passed, and was just trying to think about what it is that just seems qualitatively different to me. Why have that descriptor? And I think there's, I want to write something that is overlapping with, so I want to write something that's like recognizable as a part of this sort of larger discourse around the hospitality industry, but that is also veering from it and like sort of going in this more like quotidian, like intimate direction, that points out just these lovely opportunities that we have in these moments every day. And I think this is just this art, this talent that Black women have for making you feel welcome. It's not, I was trying to think like the word, it's not transactional. And it's not even reciprocal in that way. It really is coming from this deep understanding of the mutuality, of the connection, of in doing for you, I'm doing for myself and others, and that you'll pay that forward. So there's something about that that I really do want to capture.
I think that's beautiful. That's beautiful. I think that a lot of white people in this country don't have a great sense of community anymore. I think that like the sense of community is often lost amongst white folks in this country. I can just, that's my observation. Do you think that for the Black community that that's different, and that that is a reason for why Black hospitality amongst like Black women is more, or like how you're describing, a more kind of intimate, non-transactional thing, because the sense of community is greater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Is that, yeah.
Yeah. I think our sort of historical circumstances in this country, yeah, so we can take that long view, has kind of necessitated that viewpoint, but it is one that we should all always already have. I mean, we are connected. That is the fact. So in spite of the sort of, you know, the efforts of sort of deep privatization and, you know, all of those stories around, like you were saying earlier, you know, the bootstrap stories. I mean, there is that connection to a certain kind of, a certain brand of capitalism too. That yes, we can afford you hospitality for a price, or we can afford you hospitality because we have a certain kind of house. There's this, now how would I describe him? This theorist named Fred Moten, who I think is one of the most brilliant people alive, but he was talking about his grandmother, and you know that. That idea of hospitality is the host is able to be hospitable because of what he owns. And Fred Moten was saying, you know, my grandmother, I don't know if she ever owned a house. She lost many houses. I don't know if she owned one, but she knew how to share one. Yeah. And I think that's such a great thing to keep in mind. How do you share a house even when you don't feel like you have one or have the trappings for the magazine version?
Absolutely. Well, I think it's something that very much comes from within, and it's very learned. And I think that like you're, you know, we're kind of circling around talking about capitalism in this country and the ideal of the idea of individualism, and I, you know, capitalism particularly in regards to hospitality and how it's now bought and sold, and you know, it's really eroded what is, in essence, one of the few things that we kind of have, I don't know, that are just human, that you can always invite someone into your house for a cup of tea. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't always have to be this like grand gesture. It doesn't have to include anything specific other than, you know, being heartfelt. And it is something that I think as we progress in society, and definitely like, as individualism and many becomes more important and prevalent, and it's lost. And
right.
It's like also just kind of not part of our, I don't know. It's not, I love what you're saying. And I, you know, think of my own grandfather a bit, who like didn't have, you know, he definitely grew up with no money in the Depression. And then even when they were older, grandparents' age, they still didn't really have anything, you know? And this is a guy who would pick dandelions from the driveway and eat them and stuff like that. So, but he would had such a big heart, and he would bring those same picked dandelions to the neighbors, you know what I mean? And like, it didn't matter that there wasn't something fancy. It was like always a sense of wanting to share. And, I think that's a beautiful sentiment for sure.
Yeah. I love that. The dandelions are supposed to be good for you. I don't eat them, but I, but one of my kind of bucket list things is to learn how to forage and, you know, recognize, different plants and things like that. So yeah, I hear that there is something about dandelions that's nutritious.
Totally.
I'll find out one day. But yeah, I think that how can we hold an attitude of invitation, of inviting in, wherever we are. And, you know, I want to try to think about ways that is a, is extra human, the way to put that. I mean, I think it's a human thing, and I think the connection, but I think we have to think about it in a bigger sense, something that we can cultivate between us, but also across, I don't know, across species. I mean,
totally.
We are guests in a larger sense.
That's very true. Yeah, that's a very, very good point.
So I don't know. It's pretty ambitious, and we'll see how it goes. But yeah, there's definitely a poetics around hospitality that I'm at least interested in and want to try to speak to.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. I'm curious about a lot of things. I wish we had like three more hours, but one thing that I kind of want to talk about, and it kind of touches on some of the stuff we were talking about in the beginning with your passion and being your work and stuff like that. But, I was thinking about how when somebody orders a cake, it's often because they want it to represent their personality or their occasion or their, you know, they want it to define them or speak to them in some way. So how do you balance that, or how did you balance it, or how do you think about it in the future in terms of it communicating like your feelings and your vision and your joy and pain and all of those things that are important to you and in your work, with folks who are looking to have you kind of represent them? Like, how does that work for you?
Oh my gosh. That is like the cake designer's sort of whole issue right there. You sum that up really well. It like everything else, it was a real process for me. I want, for better or worse, I'm a big sort of pleaser, and you know, I want people to be happy. I want to, you know, give them the thing that they want. But I found that sometimes, you know, you have to have that conversation to kind of help them really, you know, massage their vision of what their cake, you know, can and maybe should be. So I was always happy to put that time in, but some people in the end, they still just want, you know, they want, what's that? Like a Pinterest cake. That's what I always call it, you know.
Sure.
They bring you the picture. It's trending. They want you to reproduce this thing. So getting the courage to kind of develop my language in a way that made sure up front that I was mostly bringing people that wanted to have that conversation with me, definitely took a while. But I was starting, you know, at like in 2019, the end of 2019, starting to really find that language and find my people. And for the most part, by then, you know, people were kind of saying, I love your style. Here are some of the design elements, or here's, you know, the setting for this occasion, and kind of just let me go. And that was ideal.
Yes, that is amazing. That. When you can find that, that's incredible.
Loved it.
I'm also curious about, so Bob, as Bobby was mentioning before, in the interview you did in Unpeeled, and you're talking about the first grief cake you made for your mom. I'm just curious, what did you do with it? What happened? What was the fate of the cake? Like, was it for you and your family? Like, what happened to it?
So, one of the tensions that has been real for me with this cake business, I mean that in the larger sense, is between the eating cakes and the designed cakes. So the eating cakes sort of seem to have this, their own sort of stories and contexts, around the ingredients, around my relationships, if I'm lucky enough with, you know, the people that grew some of that stuff, around, preserving traditions, you know, the flavor profiles create this whole story, but a lot of times the cake, you know, it looks like a frosted homemade cake. So saying that to say that the cake that I designed for my mom was a cake dummy. So it had, you know, cake forms, inside it. And it was the designing was the important process for me at the time.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
So we did not eat that.
Yeah. from what we read, you went on to make some other grief cakes. Is
that true? I did. And
can you tell us a little bit about that?
Missed that work, and I'll be happy to kind of get back to some of that. It's meaningful for me. But yeah, I made one for Ahmaud Arbery. All of these instances break my heart. The words are just so insufficient. But there was something about the story, how he was murdered, that just struck me in this way, because I was running a lot. I am a runner as well. And because when I run, I'm always aware of myself as a Black body in an environment that feels in some ways unsafe. I'm always thinking about that and about, I wrote a little piece about it, like the ghosts of runaways. I mean, it's always in the back of your head, but you are willing to manage that anxiety because, on the trail, in the woods, when you're running, that is also where you feel in right relationship with the world. So you got to do it. But yeah, his murder really struck me in a kind of way. And I wanted to design a cake for him that featured elements of things that I see on my runs that are magical. So there's just like little bits of sugar and sprinkle that I treated a certain way to look like pebbles shining in a creek. And there was some, different mushrooms and like shelf mushrooms there. So not, not traditional cake decorating stuff, but I sort of tried to push on some of those connections. But also because, the cake is, again, just such a great symbol. It represents life, and that's what we eat when we're celebrating, another year of life. That's what we eat when we are with our families and connecting in the ways that we're all supposed to be connecting. Those rituals are rituals that, his family's not going to get to have, that he's not going to get to have. So in that way, I think the cake seemed like such a, great way to connect in a more meaningful way to the fact that this person is not here anymore. This person was stolen from us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In talking about inherited trauma and, it's such a real thing. The actual, there's been so much kind of science behind it, in terms of you inherit the kind of trauma from generations past. It's like in your DNA, actually. Like with Holocaust survivors, there's been a bunch of studies on it, for instance, in Bobby's mom, my grandma was a Holocaust survivor, and is there a name for this type of inherited trauma?
It's kind of what you said. It's inherited grief. And you're right, it's in our DNA.
It really is. In the sand, to put it in, I'm really paraphrasing here, but from what I've read, it's almost like, how you sometimes have the same. Okay, so my brother, I have found out I had a long lost brother. I never knew him until my dad died, until like a couple of months after my dad died. And he's amazing, but I ended up meeting him, and he does the same weird hand gestures as my dad did. Mm. Right? So like, it's the same thing. It's like that kind of like trauma and terror and pain that like happens to our ancestors. I feel like similarly to like doing the same hand gesture to someone who you never knew, but you were related to, like it's deeply within the fabric of who you are in your cells, Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It's just such a profound and such a, it's sad. It's terrible, but it's also part of who we are and how we deal with it and how we go forward as people who we are now. It's just an interesting thing.
It's also part of our tapestry. It's not just a bad thing. It just is.
Right.
It's
That's a good way tapestry. Of putting it. Part of the tapestry, right. But it is, it's really intense. So Monica, we always ask everyone at the end, kind of as we're nearing the end of the show, if you could have given yourself kind of at the beginning of this grieving experience, a bit of advice, what would that, knowing what you know now and what you've been through, like what would that what would that advice be to your previous self?
Well, I knew that you asked this question. And I don't know. I tried to not, you know, sort of practice something in my head, and I was going to surprise myself. Like, we'll see. We'll see what I say. I'm trying to do that more, you know, not be so attached to certain outcomes, just kind of letting it go. I'm really proud of how I handled all of that. It was not always pretty. As my husband would attest, it was not. But I think I did a good job of sitting with it, of not repressing, not acting out, you know, just kind of being still and quiet and letting all of that experience sort of guide me to a deeper understanding of myself. I think now I just have this sense that you can be happy, like that's a thing, happiness, and I know that's a thing that we all sort of go towards. But what I feel more often, more times than not now, is joy, which I think always has a bit of grief in it. I think there's always that texture. So just learning how to be with it and know that, I don't know, that kind of makes the wholeness. So I think I did a good job with that. So I might remind myself to breathe and be patient. But mostly I would just say, good job, kid. You got this. I love you.
That's great. That's beautiful. And I love like the sentiment of that with joy, there's always some pain, you know? And I don't know what you think about that, but I feel like when I think about that statement, that it's like when you're really feeling joy, like real joy and not just happiness, you're like letting go and you're vulnerable in joy.
Yes.
And I think it's like those moments you realize that like, oh my God, I'm really let go. I'm free right now. And that means that this feeling will go away at some point, or all the things that I'm feeling really joyful about right now are temporary. And I don't know, like, is that what that feeling is for you at all?
It is. Now, I hate to say that I cannot remember who this guy was or where I heard this thing, but someone, probably in another podcast, was talking about this favorite glass that he had and how it brings him so much joy. And part of why it brings him joy is because in his mind, he knows it's already broken. Oh, so it helps him, you know, just appreciate and kind of be there each time he's using the glass. And I think that's something about the joy is sort of recognizing. I mean, and that's the thing about the cake too. It's that ephemerality. Mm-hmm. It's already eaten.
I've been reading this poem to my clients all week, and it's a little piece of a Mary Oliver poem, very short poem, actually. And it says, we shake with joy. We shake with joy. We shake with grief. What a time they have, these two, housed as they are in the same body.
That Mary.
She's good.
Every time, that one. Oh, yeah. Gosh.
Nothing but the hits with Mary Oliver. That's right. Oh man, Monica, this was a really beautiful conversation. It was really nice. And I know, like, I mean, it's always such a big ask to have people share their stories about grief. And, you know, it hasn't been so long since your mom has passed away and since all this kind of really traumatic time for you has happened. So thank you for, you know, going there with us so shortly after, especially it's such a generous thing to do. And we really appreciate it so much.
I appreciate you all and the space that you create with this podcast.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you for being on. This was really a beautiful, beautiful talk. And your work is beautiful and you're a wonderful person. So we were so happy to have you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And good luck with your writing and your new home.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Thank you. And yay, Georgia.
Yeah. Right?
Thank you.
Yeah. There is a reason for joy.
Absolutely. Yeah. There you go. All right, Monica, it's great to talk to you. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
My name is Sarah Kim, and I'm from Austin, Texas. I'm a Cheeselandian because while life is great, cheese makes it better. Wisconsin cheese has proven time and time again to be a delicious expression of craft, hard work, and tradition. As a Cheeselandian, I am able to share a Gouda experience with fellow cheese and food lovers nationwide, as well as connect with cheese producers and cheesemongers, taking my love of cheese to another level. I invite you to join Cheeselandia because during these difficult times, it has been even more important to take it easy and get cheesy. The Cheeselandia community and events have been the glue helping to keep us together and connected, and I would love it if you would join me. And let's face it, if you hear the word cheese and get a little hungry, then you've found a place you can call home. To find out more about Cheeselandia, go to cheeselandia.com.
Thank you so much for joining us for Processing. We realize that sharing these types of deeply intimate stories on air is a very personal decision. We began this project as a way to connect our listeners through shared experiences and storytelling. We hope that Processing can be a platform for sharing, learning, and healing. We appreciate our guests' willingness to be vulnerable and value nothing more than making both our guests' and listeners' experiences with our show positive and progressive. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or writing in a listener letter, please email processing@heritageradionetwork.org. Please follow us at processing_podcast on Instagram. Processing is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.